We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Five Star App Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpus, co-founder of Meditation Studio and your host on Untangle, along with my co-host every other week, Ariel Garten, co-founder of Muse, the brain sensing headband. Join us each week as we introduce you to authors, experts, and thought leaders who share their stories on how meditation and mindfulness practices have the power to change our lives. Today's guest is Ruth King, an international teacher in the insight meditation tradition, a life coach and emotional wisdom teacher, and the author of an amazing book called Mindful of Race, Transforming Racism from the Inside Out. In this transformational book, Ruth shows us how to use mindfulness to explore our feelings about race, to really see how we've been conditioned, and how this just might be at the root of our suffering and confusion. She deeply believes that it's possible to shift our racial distress, to change, and to reach across the giant divide and create a culture where we listen to and respect one another and begin to heal our suffering. She is truly one of the most dynamic and compassionate people I know, with a giant heart. Before we get started, just a little reminder to check out our app, Meditation Studio, with meditations designed to help you with many of life's challenges and to inspire you just when you need it. Now, here's Ruth.
Ruth, it's just so great to have you on Untangle today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
I want to tell our audience a little bit about your background. And you grew up in the late 60s in South Central LA. It was right in the heart of the civil rights movement. Can you tell us a little bit about some of your observations and feelings during this time?
Yes. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles. I come from a family of eight. I have seven siblings. I actually have five now. And we grew up in a working class neighborhood and with a single mom. It was very alive in terms of civil rights activities, but it was also very alive with jazz. So there was this interesting blend, which I really value music a lot because I think it brings a certain creative edge and comfort to some of the struggles around race. At least that was my experience in my family, who were jazz musicians and percussionists as well. And so there was just a lot of struggle, a lot of hardship. There was a lot of physical violence in my family. You have to keep your arms around your kids tight because somebody could hurt them, somebody could snatch them, some system could be imposed on them. So I felt that tightness both in the community, but also inside my family. And one of the most vivid images for me as a young person around race was watching my great-grandmother pace quite a bit. She worried a lot about these Black bodies that were in her life, and she couldn't protect them. And I think I just saw the wear and tear and the cumulative chronic fatigue that she lived and breathed moment to moment. And I remember how hard it was that I couldn't comfort her. And when she died, I think I made some kind of deal with myself. As I'm not going out like that. I think my great-grandmother would be happy to know I'm doing walking meditation instead of pacing the the floor. Right. So it was an atmosphere of fear and trepidation, not really knowing what's going to hit next. A lot of sadness and joy, but I think mostly an atmosphere of fear that we tried to make the best of for the most part.
As a little girl, how did you make sense of all of this?
Well, I don't know if there was any kind of intellectual way that that was happening. I felt like my body absorbed a lot of what I couldn't make sense out of. So by the time I was 27, I had open heart surgery from a mitral valve prolapse. But I think it was really because the body was just absorbing so much that felt pretty unbearable. I mean, I come from a people that found a way to be resilient. My people are from slaves trying to deal with mothers having their babies taken from them. And so there's been this kind of in the bones way of figuring things out that's not so much in the head. And so I think that really worked that heart muscle in a big way.
Wow.
At least for me.
Do you see that as a really big turning point for you? Maybe it's like your heart broke open.
Exactly. I mean, I think that it was, I came to see it different from a surgical procedure to a more spiritual procedure, because I often say that was my first silent retreat when I woke up from that surgery and could feel the weight in my life that was really on the inside sitting on the top of my chest now. And just that whole awareness of what this body was holding, and over time, what relief it was to just have a procedure, if you will, or an intervention on the heart, where I was actually trusting white people with my heart, something I didn't really have full access to. I come from a family that didn't trust going into the doctors, and because a lot of people in my family went to the doctors and didn't come back home. This was a big story in our community. And so there was a lot of fear. So race was always wrapped around things in my life. There was always a racial way that I had to be concerned with, because my body and people that look like me and dark bodies are targets of harm. I mean, that's just kind of the world we walk in, certainly growing up. And to some degree, we see that now with immigration. We see it with a lot of, with the uprise right now of so much racial hatred and emboldenedness in
right.
the country.
It's so heartbreaking that it's still so prevalent. Did you know before your open heart surgery that you wanted to work in this area? You wanted to teach organizations about cultural diversity, or did that come later?
Well, I don't know if I knew that as a young person, because when I grew up in my family and in my community, the emphasis was more on survival than education. So right. I was well in my 30s before I started exploring what my work might be. I always had a curiosity about families and systems and what brought happiness. And I think it was an early longing of wanting something more than just to survive. I think there was some part of me that knew that, but I can't say when that happened. But I came into organizational development through a woman that really saw me and what I was capable of and kind of mentored me into a field as an apprentice. And then I went into graduate school and then was trained in culture and leadership and a number of diversity avenues, and then continued training in a number of other areas. And then I saw that political systems inside of organizations and corporations were very similar to families, and the same dynamics went on. I then became very excited about studying psychology, and so I went to school and got a degree in that. So these two systems parallel to me, and race is at the core of it on many levels, because it has to do with our psychological conditioning, and it also has to do with the way we move inside cultures and what defines membership and all of that.
Yeah, so when you did go into organizations and you began teaching cultural diversity, what kinds of obstacles did you have, and how do we actually sort of shift and change all of these habitual views that are so embedded in our world and in our ways of seeing the world?
Yeah, that's a big question. And the focus is a little different depending on what environment you're in. In the corporate world, there was a big move back in the 80s where corporations were beginning to wake up to the fact that diversity was kind of an impinging kind of influence, or people were coming into the organizations that were different than the dominant white culture. So that meant something other than representation. The cultures were beginning to get some understanding that this required something other than what was commonly referred to as affirmative action. You just get representation in. You needed to change the culture. You needed to change the heart. You basically needed to be willing to look at whiteness in order to understand how to make an organization of belonging a reality instead of something that is more tokenized or appendaged to a mindset that hasn't really woke itself up around race. So I think inside of organizations that are profit-driven, the motivation sometimes around this work is not always around waking up to how this actually works. It's really driven by something else, which is usually profit or the bottom line or things like that. So to really get diversity and inclusion and belonging and a sense of vitality, full-blown vitality inside of an organizational culture really is a long-term process. And most corporations, the gateway for beginning to understand that, even back in the 80s and still today, has been through training interventions. So there were training programs that I designed and delivered inside of corporate America that raised awareness around race and racial impact. And that was helpful. But what happens is when people have information, it's different than it being integrated personally and also
yes.
integrated in systems. So it had a shelf value until the culture was really ready to change. And I just think it's big work and it takes a while. There were many successes along the way. I continue to do a bit of that work today. It could be very rewarding when you have a leader that is willing to go the long haul to look at it. And some leaders are, and some leaders are just kind of wanting some training to, because somebody's about to sue them for some kind of act of, so then they want training for that.
It does seem like you need a leader on the inside that can be a constant advocate, because you're right. I mean, people understand it in their heads. They understand the challenge and they understand how they might need to change. But to really examine your own values and ways that you behave that you aren't even aware of. And to me, that was the sort of biggest gift of your book, is that it really helped me personally to understand ways that I am that I haven't even really been aware of. So I think it's interesting to kind of truly implement change inside of an organization and inside of a culture and look inside of our country, right? Because it does take so much time to change these really embedded views.
Well, it takes time and it also takes deep introspection and it takes a lot of heart. If you look at our country and you look at different ways that race has been dealt with over the generations, there's been some shifts in policy, for example. You know, mm-hmm. there's been things that people have been forced to do because it's now law or it's constitutional or it's something yeah. that they've been forced to do. But the forcing of those things, which are important, doesn't change the heart and it doesn't change the fundamental mindset that people have towards what I refer to as subordinated groups, culturally subordinated groups in this country. I think you can use some progress is better than none, getting policies changed. But when it comes to changing hearts, I think that requires somebody to really be willing to look deeply at themselves and their conditioning and the gratitude and danger of holding on to a point of view that actually causes harm. And to me, this is fundamentally about harm and non-harm. So it's important that we be willing to really look at our participation in that.
Well, we'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is "Take comfort in Born shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
You also said in your first book was about rage. It was this process for you, I think, to find your own voice and be in touch with your own feelings, but it still was about anger and rage. And was it when you started studying insight meditation that you started shifting how you might deal with the issues, or did that happen through some other mechanism?
Well, it's hard to know when it actually happened because both of these books are really kind of birthed through an experience of my life and all of the rivers that are running in different directions right underneath the surface of the ocean, right? But yeah, this rage really felt like a couple of things. One, it felt very initiatory. It felt like an energy that was really not horrible as much as it was something that was calling for my attention. And so it was a big teacher in my life. And what I wanted to do with that work was just help people see that rage is not just about when you are belligerent and you just kind of go off on someone. That rage is also manifested, especially in our bodies, as depression or as distraction, as devotion to things that serve against what we're really here to do. And yes, there is a type of rage that is defiant and belligerent, but there's 5 other ways that we can begin to recognize that rage is operating in our lives. And that there is a way that mindfulness meditation supports a shift in our relationship to the energy of rage, to the heat of it, to our aversion to it, and to our addiction to it, that we can begin to shift and look at how we have been relating to this intense energy in a caring way and kind of cool our own fires around rage instead of expecting that that's going to always be something that happens external to us. So that was really what that book was about, trying to really help us get our arms around this young, unattended, uncared for energy that we are habituated around and listen to it more closely, be with it more lovingly, and see what it's here to teach us. And it's from that that we can then kind of let it go or soften around it or not be in reaction to it.
So can you talk a little bit more about how, and this is really what your book is about, but how a mindfulness practice, how it works to really help us address our racial issues and look at how we've been conditioned and to see ourselves more honestly. And you talk about really staying present with what makes us feel uncomfortable. And I think that's one of the hardest things for us to do in any situation. And if we are dealing with rage, even more so. So can you talk a little bit about this sort of tool that we have to transform our relationship to our suffering here?
Yeah, it's such a good question, Patricia. I think, first of all, one of the things we first need to get our arms around is how we've been conditioned to relate to race. We have to be willing to look at the shape of racial dynamics. So one question I often ask people, why are matters of race still matters of concern? And what does that have to do with you? So we really need to get that understanding. We need to deepen and be willing to look at our conditioning around race, because that's what we then sit on the cushion with. Mm-hmm. It's through that investigation that we understand what we actually need to investigate or engage when we're sitting on the cushion. If most white people, for example, who are not always aware of themselves as a collective, as a member in whiteness, many white people don't get. They see themselves more as individuals, not so much as a part of a racial group identity. So if race doesn't come up in your mind as an inquiry or as something you really want to investigate and more deeply understand, especially in terms of what it has to do with you, then when you sit on the cushion, it's not going to come up. So we need that understanding of our conditioning where we're like, what did grandma used to say? And how was my father? And how did I turn away from this situation? Or what did I hate about this? And we need to look at that in order to have the stimulus to sit with and investigate when we're on the cushion. Because when we sit down, we bring our lives to the cushion. So the lack of having racial awareness means there's going to be a lack of investigation on the cushion. So that's fundamental in my mind. And then when we sit on the cushion and we just watch the news, for example, and we're aware of ourselves being all ensnarled or enraged about the latest thing that's there or the latest body of color that's, we're then sitting with our outrage about it or our numbness about it or our concern or worry about it. We're sitting with our hindrances, right? This is what we can then investigate on the cushion. What are my habits of mind? One of the tools I invite people to use is that tool on RAIN that we hear so often in the meditation community, where we recognize what's happening. What is the thought that's there? What are my beliefs? What's got me wrapped around the throat right now? What does that feel like in the body? Where is my breath right now? What's my temperature? Am I on fire? Am I buzzing? So we begin to look at what's happening in this body and mind and heart as I sit on the cushion. So that's the R. Can I recognize it? The A is, can I allow it to be here? Can I be with this? Sometimes the A is, the allow is, no, I can't be with this. And we need to maybe take a walk, or we need to get in nature, or we need to work out physically. Sometimes we can't be with it. Sometimes the nervous system won't allow it. But if we can allow it, then that takes us to a deeper place of investigating what's there and looking at our relationship to it, looking at our aversion to what we're seeing. Like sometimes people tell me, well, what I'm seeing in my mind is not how I see myself, and I can't stand that. These are all important things to kind of be with or to kind of allow to arise and pass away. And sometimes we feel, and when we're sitting on the cushion, people have reported, I just feel like this is never going to end. And the truth of the matter is that it does end. There are times when the emotions or the beliefs or images are very intense. And then there are times when they soften. And we don't want to miss those times in the meditation practice. And then there's the nurturing. We investigate. We look at our relationship to what's arising. And then we want to offer some care to that. We want to ask ourselves, what's needed in this moment? What can I give myself in this moment that would be kind, that would be gentle, that would honor what's feeling? And sometimes that looks like just an affirmation, you know, of course you're outraged. Of course this makes sense. We can be with this together. Sometimes I say things like that to myself when I'm in the meditation process. So RAIN can be helpful, I think, in kind of deconstructing our relationship to the intense emotion or the blank emotion. Sometimes it's not intense at all. Sometimes it's just numb or confusion. That can be investigated as well.
Yeah, I love what you're saying about using that technique, because I remember having been in corporate life for many, many years, and a lot of the training that we had was diversity training, but it got at behavior, not heart or not belief.
Yes.
And so you knew what had to change and you knew what policies needed to change, but it didn't really get underneath the skin. And I think you said something in the book, I love this term, we're like generationally recycled, and this conversation, it leaves us breathless or it makes our skin crawl, but we have to investigate it and really get inside that feeling tone that freaks us out and keeps us out of the conversation. And that's, I'm sort of imagining that you would use that technique, even use the RAIN technique in organizations where people could begin to really sort of get underneath what's there.
And be with what's there as well, because it frightens us. What we feel around rage does make our skin crawl. It's scary. So to be able to kind of hang out with it without fixing anything, without making it go, without hating it, to just be able to hang out with the intensity and see that it is impermanent, see that it is just an inflammation, and then be able to notice when that shifts, I find that to be outrageously liberating for people when they begin to realize that this is not a permanent state. What I'm thinking, what I'm feeling, what I'm believing right now, it's not a permanent state. And through the breath of a, you know, a 30-minute sit, you might see the mind do any number of things, and you can see the mind just doing what it does, which is changing time.
Yeah. Do you think that racism has changed within organizations and companies since you first started consulting?
I don't know if I've seen major cultural changes. I kind of sense that there's more hope around this. I think there is change. I just don't think there's sweeping change. I think there could be a fundamental challenge if profit is the driving force. I think when the driving force is profit, usually somebody's going to be exploited at that expense. I don't always trust that those two motivations can coexist. Maybe they can, I don't know. But I just think that's a fundamental flaw in the psyche of a capitalist kind of construct. And when capitalist and whiteness and a denial of looking at collective power and impact, that and the power that white people have collectively and pervasively in our society, I think the two things kind of go together around cultures might be able to change if the leadership and cultures are able to get their arms around whiteness and the impact that that has had generationally and systemically through policies, practices, beliefs, norms, greed, all of that. If somebody's willing to look at that, then that's really something. But characteristically of being dominant is that you don't look at those types of things.
Right.
You know.
Right. Yeah.
You just don't have to. So you really have to want to. A lot of people like me get called into corporations when somebody's suing them. So again, there's that expense piece, and it's usually around race. So it's those two things kind of join together. Okay, so we're going to get hit again around our racial policies here. We're going to have to pay out a lot of money. So let's go find some training, which is a Band-Aid if it's not integrated into cultural accountability, a leadership tied to compensation. These are things that I think begin to dismantle some of the infrastructure that works against having a culture of belonging.
Yeah.
Hello, listeners. This is Michael from the Psychologists of the Clock podcast. If you like what you hear on Untangle, let me extend a friendly invitation to check out our show as well. We are four experts in psychology that bring you cutting-edge and science-based ideas to help you flourish in your relationships, work, and health. You can find Psychologists of the Clock wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, and you can visit our website at offtheclockpsych.com.
I love this quote in the book, "To understand racial habits of harm, the ways we avoid more genuine connection and healing as individuals and racial groups is to dive below our knee-jerk responses beneath the words themselves to really examine our conditioning. And this requires us to work with our mind in order to transform our heart." And then you talked about this concept of our ultimate versus relative identity, which I think is so hard for people to understand if they haven't been trained in mindfulness or they haven't really gone down this path because... And I think the hardest thing, and I'm so curious about this, is how do we change those who don't see the reality of their habits? They just don't live in that place where they think that their habits are charged in any way. They believe that their habits are the way things should be.
Here we are as humans, right? And sometimes I have to look at, it's a harsh reality, this area. Because most people that don't want to look at it are white people. Again, I think it's also characteristic of being in a dominant group where you have power. So the motivation around looking is not really kind of high on the list. So sometimes when I look at myself and I think this is just human to human, when somebody's trying to make me change something about myself, it's like, good luck with that. You're not going to make me change because you think it's a good idea. I have to be willing to see the impact I'm having. I have to care about it enough to really take a double look. So it really comes down to that in a way. People like in corporations that are in positions of power who may not even see themselves as powerful because at an individual level, they don't feel powerful, but at a group level, you're in a position of power. So most individuals are looking at themselves solely, but white people are not always looking at the fact that they're a part of a group that's dominant in our society. So how they use that power is really important. I'm trying to work with people who have enough inclination of this being important and they're willing to partner in opening around this a little bit more, understanding that it's scary, understanding that the heart quakes and people close back up, but you're committed over some time to really looking at how this becomes more real for you. I think that's a real tender territory. That's a lot of access to somebody who's scared and might screw it up. And a lot of white folks are really addicted to perfection. They don't want to get it wrong and don't want to be called a racist. I mean, all these things are in there. And all of that's at risk when you start to do this work. And yeah. So can you sign up for that is really what we're asking people to do. And I think it's important, but you have to be willing to think it's important also, not just because somebody else is saying it's important, but you see, again, yeah. What does this have to do with me? Why are matters of race still happening after all this time? And what does this have to do with me? You have to really want that second part. You want to step into that second part of the question.
It's so interesting the way you talk about that because you really do have to sign up for self-reflection. And there are plenty of people that just don't live in that territory. And you talked in the book about this, there were two concepts I really, really liked in addition to the whole book. One was the concept of these perceptual knots that we have, these sort of misperceptions that keep mm-hmm. us thinking. You talk about like life, that we think it's this distorted way of thinking that life is personal or permanent. And then you talk about this concept of papancha, which I actually hadn't heard about that, but it sounds like it's the extra layers of meaning or stories that we put on top of things, how we interpret or judge. So I thought that was really interesting because so much of our understanding, our beliefs, our values are based on all of these past preferences and beliefs and experiences.
Totally.
Can you talk a little bit about those concepts?
It kind of ties to the question you were asking a moment ago about ultimate and relative and how difficult that is to understand outside of the meditative arena. But it can be better understood if you look at it from the standpoint of individual and collective. So individual, if we look at our relative reality, what we're really talking about is our relational field as humans. How we've been conditioned to relate to each other is a relative, a relational, a kinship field in these fear bodies that we walk in, right?
Right.
And then this ultimate reality is really our spiritual higher selves reality where we're not these concepts. We're not a race. We're not so much a gender. We're not all these labels that we have created. These labels get created in order to navigate our relational field. And within this relational field of relative reality, we're severed and separated through concepts and perceptions and conditioning. So this idea of what I say in the book about life is not personal, it's not permanent, it's not perfect, that's a spiritual concept in terms of dealing with a very harsh reality, which is everything that's happening is changing all the time. Even if it hasn't changed enough for our preference,
right.
Nothing that happens is going to be totally satisfying because we can't rely on it to stay that way forever. People we love die, the body ages, and the cute little puppy poops. So it's not perfect. So it's not permanent, it's not perfect, and it's not personal in the sense that there's so much complexity to us as humans. And sometimes we take things very personally. When shit just happens, sometimes it happens. We can begin to see, though, in relative reality, that shit happens to certain people, certain groups of people, more than other people. And that's the piece we want to start paying attention to, not just individual actions, but collective patterns and constellations that are at play in our relational cultural field, where harm is being done to certain people, types of people, groups of people, colors of people, more so than other people. So I think that's how this begins to happen. And we start to delayer that, or what I've heard, kind of decolonize the mind or deconstruct our habitual habits in this relative field by looking at that concept of papancha. We look at papancha to see, what am I adding to this from the past that complicates it more than it may need to be complicated at this time? What layers of belief and emotion am I putting on this present moment experience that distorts just the bareness of the experience itself? So papancha is useful as a concept and scene. The image I used in the book was one of a mannequin, where the mannequin doesn't have any clothes on it, right? But then we layer all these clothes and these tapestries and fabrics and colors on top because we like the way that looks. We're just used to it looking that way.
Right. We're such creatures of habit, aren't we? It's crazy.
But the good thing about habits is that they can change.
It's a little bit hard, but yes. Well, and in the book, what are some of the other practices that you think can help us be more open to changing our own habits? And you talk about compassion and forgiveness. What do you think the people that are listening here today can do to be more open to change?
I do think that this is really an area that is just, the heart has to be wrapped all around it. And there's things we can do on the cushion, which are pretty well described in the book. But I think the issues around race really live loud. I mean, we just don't know our impact until we are out there open to seeing what our impact is. But I think one of the ways that really can get us down into that deep territory where we don't have to go searching too far is we can begin to look at the children and talk to the children about race. And there's a story in the book that came to me after I'd been on a long retreat for white people called The Untold. And The Untold is this kind of thought I had about what would it be like if white people were to talk to all of their children about the racial conditioning that is a part of the history as they understand it, and to really own all of that. So I'm suggesting that one of the things we could do to stay right in the heart of this matter is to not have race be silent in our families and with our children, so that they could develop a language, they can begin to be more comfortable in exploring and looking at themselves, that they can know their history. I'm talking about everybody, all children. That they can see their parents with a bit more racial literacy and racial comfort just in talking about race, so that it doesn't become the big thing in the shadows or in the closet for people. I think that's a real exercise of waking up around this taboo, especially with white people. And I think for people of color, there's talking about race, but there's also, for us, I feel like it's talking about tenderness. And it's talking about compassion, and it's talking about how we can heal together through sharing our stories. Sometimes for us as people of color, we're collected in our group identity, but we haven't really paid attention to our individual distinction within the body of color, our own particular stories and journeys, and what attention that might need and support those stories might need from each of us. I think there's two chapters in the book, one that deals what white folks need to do, and then another chapter on what people of color must do. And there's about three or four suggestions there that I think are helpful. But I think in both of those chapters, I'm encouraging talking to the children about race so that this is not so difficult for them. Racial history, racial conditioning, making that personal. Talking about your grandfather, your great-grandfather, where you came from, what you're afraid of.
Yeah, it seems like it would be so helpful to have it be part of a curriculum for young children in schools.
The other thing that comes up is, if you can't talk about race to the children, what's that about? That's what gets to be investigated on the cushion. Again, why is it hard for me to talk to my kids about my programming and what I grew up believing and what we think is right? And or what stories am I telling my kids by not talking about this? Because when I was in Virginia working with the Charlottesville people around this training, I remember the mayor speaking after the rally and the woman Heather was killed. And the mayor stood up and he said, I want all these alt-right people and national white nationalists to leave our fair city. And my question is, where are they going to go? So where do you think they're going? And if you're not dealing with them, guess who's picking up the slack? Most people of color are having to pick up that slack. And those are somebody's children, all these alt-right people, whoever, you know. What is the belief in there? And where are the parents? What's being planted? What's being planted will bloom.
Yeah, there's so much here, Ruth. Thank you so much. I feel like this is such an important conversation in your book. It's a must read for everyone, really. I mean, just think it's such an important book. So thank you so much for writing it. And
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed this.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks so much to Ruth King for joining us. For more information, check out her website at ruthking.net. You can find her books at all major booksellers. If you have feedback or suggestions for guests, email us at founders@meditationstudioapp.com. And don't forget to check out Meditation Studio in the App Store and check out Muse at choosemuse.com. We'll see you next time.